Oppenheimer.
I think they're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
Listen, Nerd Right Radio!
Nerd Alert!
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
And welcome to episode 14 of Nerd Pride Radio. 14, the number of days in a fortnight, and the number of pounds in a stone. So ask me how I'm doing today. Go on, ask me. I am awesome. My name is Mike Jones. I'm a D&D nerd, a sci-fi nerd, a comic book nerd, computer nerd, movie nerd, science nerd, gaming nerd, and about seven other kinds of nerd I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You're listening to Nerd Pride Radio, the place I go every week to haver on about all the nerd stuff that I just can't fit in my brain anymore. And for the second month in a row, users have voted us the best-smelling podcast on the internet. Turns out, we smell like the Starfleet Academy locker rooms, and it seems the listeners like that. Before we do anything else, though, updates! Yeah, last week I told you that I was going to try and start a steampunk game on my forums, and as it turns out, with the help of many other users on the forums, we are doing exactly that. It's a steampunk version of the TV show Firefly, so with that same kind of concept, it will be an ocean world with steam-powered airships that transport cargo and people between chains of islands. And we will be, our characters will be, the crew of a Firefly-class airship, much like this show Firefly. And we're just really excited about it. It's going to be full of swashbuckling action and personal drama, and we've got 8 or 9 people who've signed on and actually made characters already. I have not made my own character because I have talked myself into being GM for the first segment, and then after we get through the first mission, someone else takes over, I'll throw a character into the mix. It actually looks like it's going to be a ton of fun. Got to go get a plot started, start linking these characters together and making things happen, because I'm really excited about this. So I will keep you guys updated on how the game progresses, how we like doing the drama action stuff on a bulletin board, and as we come up with different rules and constructs for how we play the game, maybe I'll put that together too into a game design segment. We'll find out. Anyway, I'm very, very excited. I'll keep you posted. Sadly, though, that leads us to our next segment.
Everything right is wrong again.
That's right. It's time for yet another installment in our all-too-frequent segment, Mike Was Wrong. Yeah, apparently I forgot my shit. Yeah, I let this shit get completely screwed up last week. I played a song from Never Shout Never entitled This Shit Gets Old, and wisely, I played the song. I remembered to go back and edit out the word shit from the song lyrics themselves, and then when I announced the title of the song, This Shit Gets Old, I remembered to go and edit the shit out of that one. And then at the very end of the show, I always read off the music in the credits as well, and in that one, I said This Shit Gets Old again, and I forgot to go back and take the shit out of it. So I completely screwed up, and I left the shit in the podcast. If you want to hear me say shit, then please go back to that last podcast, episode 13, listen to the credits. I'm not going to go fix it now. It's just too late. My shit's already out there. There's nothing I can do about it. I've completely, completely screwed my shit up. So I apologize. I don't mean to be that sort of podcast, but sometimes things happen, right? We're going to let it go. Call it good. We're going to move on. Because now it's time for the meticulously plotted portion of the podcast. In this section, this is the time for me where I talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week. If something strikes me as interesting, I add it to my master list. And the best stuff gets spewed out onto you guys every week when I record. You lucky dogs. And the first thing on the master list, time to go to the science corner.
She blinded me with science. She blinded me with science.
And that music means if you don't walk away now, you might be in danger of learning something. So, did I mention that the name of our steampunk game is going to be Archipelago? Did I say that? Because when we created the steampunk game, I put out an open call for good names because all of mine suck. And Elia had suggested the name Archipelago. which I thought was brilliant. And he said it could be the name of the world itself, because clearly we're made up of chains of islands that will be representative of our planetary systems. And we could also make it the name of our ship, the Archipelago. I'm like, that is awesome. Awesome. So that's the name we've adopted. Although now my mind is toying with, I just listened to a hardcore history podcast about the French Revolution and its links to later revolutions and the Red Scare and all this. Anyway, it doesn't make any difference. They did a lot of talk about anarchy and that. And I thought, wow, what if we called it Anarchipelago? And then I thought, no, that's too clever by half. I don't think we're going to go that far. Either way, the whole point, and the way this ties to my science corner, is I went to go look up archipelago because I wasn't sure how to pronounce it, if I have to be totally honest. It's one of those words that I've mostly just seen in print, and so I assume it's archipelago, but there's a part of my brain that nags at me and says, well, what if it's archipelago? What if you're saying it wrong and you're going to look like an idiot on the podcast? Okay, well, I'm going to look like an idiot anyway, but I'll at least go confirm my pronunciation. So turns out it's archipelago, but in looking up archipelago, the Wikipedia entry for it has a picture and links to or mentions something about the world. That's the name of an archipelago, the name of a group of islands. It's the World Islands. Okay, that's caught my attention. Someone's actually named their islands the world. How do you get that? Well, as it turns out, if you are a sultan in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates, your money says you can do whatever you want. All right, and in this case, his money has wrought an engineering freaking marvel, as the people of Dubai are wont to do. He's gone out and put together 200 or so islands, man-made islands, completely, wholly created out of whole cloth in the waters right off the coast of Dubai. In fact, 2.5 miles off the coast of Dubai. And these 200 islands are arranged so that from above, it looks like a map of the world. They're not kidding about this. All right, and the islands are all different shapes and sizes, but, you know, most of them, some of them are, you know, big enough to be, you know, a private estate, a huge luxury mansion, whatever, that, you know, if you've got enough money to buy your own island in the world, you can go out there and put your huge multi-million dollar home out there. Or most of them are big enough that if you want to put a luxury resort on there, all right, if you want your spa and resort, if you want your, I mean, and some of them are freaking huge and wrap around the whole edge of the continent that they're a part of. Either way, these things are massive and amazing, and I can't believe they actually put this thing together. I mean, you go look at an aerial map of Dubai, and there, right off the coast, hey, look, it's a map of the world done in islands in the ocean. Just unreal. Okay, and it turns out this guy started this project in 2002, 2003, and he put his money to good work out there. And with the whole concept, obviously, of having this whole world of luxury resorts with, you know, different continents and different cities and countries having themes based on their areas of the world. They don't have to, but a lot of them do. There's an Irish development company who's bought the island of Ireland, and they're going to put an Irish-themed resort on it. All right, someone's bought up all of Australia and New Zealand, and they're working with that. So the islands have, 60% of them have been sold. And then sadly, 2008, the financial crisis hit, and all development stopped. They have been sitting completely empty. The islands are built, ready, done. Utilities, electricity, water, everything runs out to these islands underground. Everything's out there, all linked up, ready to build, ready to go, and they will do nothing now. All right. And sadly for them, there's even a rumor now that the islands are sinking back into the water, although it's a completely unfounded rumor, and the developers will tell you it is completely and totally untrue. So if you have a spare $1 billion or so laying around, and you want to go build that private home, you want to go build that luxury resort, $1 billion will maybe get you a start on it, I suppose. Then you know what? I still think it's a wise investment. Don't listen to the rumors. There's absolutely no proof of any of that. Get out there. Get your money going now while you can get it on ground floor. This is an opportunity you cannot pass up. Just amazing. Go check it out. Go look it up. Go check out Google Maps. Go look at it. It's just unreal. Absolutely unreal. Totally worth 5 minutes of your time. Well, of course, you know, that's not all I've been doing. I've also been watching a little TV lately.
And I know it's just that scene on TV.
Yeah, this is just as seen on TV. This is the stuff I've been watching, and I don't watch much, as I've told you before. But some stuff catches my attention. And this week, last night in fact, I caught American Horror Story. Have you seen this show yet? Unbelievable. It's on FX, and I've never caught any of the FX series that have come before because they've been highly touted, critically acclaimed, and clearly they push the envelope, push the boundaries of what is allowed on basic cable television. And American Horror Story, from what I can tell of the one episode I saw, is absolutely no different. Holy cow! I'm not going to go into a lot of detail because I think I like the show, but I would have to watch it from the beginning because I don't know if I like it just because it's so shocking and so out there. It's just like nothing that I'm watching on other television. And so part of me sees that appeal in it, that, I mean, it's highly sexual and highly charged and very violent and just stuff that you're not used to seeing. And so maybe that's why I like it. But either way, I'm going to go back. I think Nadia and I are going to go back and watch from the very beginning and just see how we feel about the show, because it looks really interesting. But more importantly than that, the thing that I was really taken away from it is man, when they talk about pushing the boundaries of what's allowed on basic cable, and you know, look, I know Americans are prudes. All right, don't worry about informing me that, you know, in Europe and other countries and continents that these same issues are not a problem. All right, yes, in America here, we have a huge problem with sex on our television. We have a huge problem with nudity and sexual content and sexual discussion of any sort, and yet we have no problem with extreme and graphic violence in most cases, whereas in some other nations, a lot of other places, the sex really doesn't bother them at all, but the violence is a little more of a concern for them. So it's a cultural thing, and I get that, but regardless of what the situation is, this is really going to the edge. I mean, this was, you know, using just language that, you know, you would never hear on TV 10 years ago. All right. This is, I mean, the use of the word shit was ubiquitous in this episode, not to mention graphic references and depictions of sexual acts and sexual discussion. It was just bizarre. But right after I saw that. No, it was right before I saw that, because I saw that with my wife in the evening. But earlier in the day, I'd been watching Mad, which is on Cartoon Network, I think, now. And Mad is a little sketch show comedy clip thing based on Mad Magazine, and it makes fun of pop culture in general for kids, on a kid's level. And it's actually kind of cool for what it does. My kids enjoy watching it. You know, I've gotten a couple of chuckles out of it. But I was amazed because they did the Avatar parody, and they named their Avatar parody Avaturd, which is not terribly clever or terribly funny in any way, but it does include the word turd, which, again, 5-10 years ago, you just didn't see in a kid's TV program. All right. In fact, when I was a kid, you didn't hear turd on any TV program, adult or kids. So this is a bizarre step. I mean, the references to farts and the use of the word crap, and even to hear, you know, someone like on iCarly, someone saying, oh my God, and using the Lord's name in vain. Things you never would have heard when I was a child. I don't even know if I have a point, really. It's just shocking that the difference is there. And personally, I think it's a good thing. At least for the most part, I think it's a good thing. You know, I don't see a need to be so prudish about stuff. I like seeing a different variety of material. And with the way the world works nowadays, with the different ways I can take in my media, whether it's, you know, regular TV, cable TV, pay channels, Hulu, my Instant Watch, my Netflix, going to the movies, there's all sorts of venues for taking in stuff. Right? The internet is a wild smorgasbord of all sorts of things. It's really, you know, my job as a parent to make sure that, you know, I understand what my kids are watching. And if I find something inappropriate for them, then okay, they don't get to see it until they're older, until they're ready for it. Or if they do see it now, you know, is it appropriate for them to see it with my guidance, or with my discussion with them? Yeah, whatever. Leave it up to parents, because we have so many things out there. It just, like I say, just kind of floored me. I you know what, this turned all preachy. That's not the way I wanted this to go. I just wanted to go, wow, I can't believe kids' TV can say turd. That's just weird. It didn't need to be any deeper than that. Turd. Okay. Ah, I think I've made my point. And we're going to go straight from TV into movies with the science fiction double feature.
Science fiction double feature.
That's right. Here at Nerd Pride Radio, you get not one, but two movie reviews for the same low, low price. Although, actually, technically, today I'm not really doing movie reviews. Right now, I want to talk about a specific category of movies that I love. All right, I adore these movies. And these are I guess the best label for them is Deconstructionist Films, but it's not really even that so much, I guess to a degree. These are films that reference and kind of pick apart a specific genre, a specific style, but they do it by actually working within that style of movie or TV show or whatever the media is. And in the end, they, my favorite ones, the best ones, by the end, they become the very thing that they're mocking. But they do it in a very self-aware way that is just kind of loving and honest. And okay, now enough speaking in brainy terms here. Let me bring this down to some specific examples. All right, my absolute favorite movie of this Oppenheimer! My favorite in this genre is the movie Galaxy Quest. All right, and a lot of people, I know, it stars Tim Allen. You gotta take that and be ready for it. Tim Allen is not a great actor or performer in general. However, in Galaxy Quest, the man is dead on. The whole movie of Galaxy Quest is dead on. The entire point of this is it tells the story of the TV show Galaxy Quest, which is essentially Star Trek. Make no mistake, they're making fun of Star Trek. And it is what happens when the show is dead, the actors have not been able to move on, all they do is go to conventions, relive past glories, they're washed up, they really are, and yet now suddenly they're put in a situation where they have to live out their TV show for real. Where does it go from here? And so it makes fun of all these things in the TV show, because the TV show, their version of Star Trek, has come to life for them, and it's once it's really there in real life, smacking them in the face nonstop, that they get to see how stupid some of the things that they did were. And yet, at no point in this movie do you ever forget that the writers are completely and totally in love with Star Trek. All right, they're making fun of it. They're picking it apart. They're having a great time with it. But by the end of the movie, it becomes a spectacular Star Trek movie, and very lovingly so, and these people come out heroes, and it's beautiful, and I have a great ton of fun with this thing. I love it. And so that's my first of these movies. Oh, which, by the way, okay, in addition to Tim Allen, who is probably the least talented cast member on this movie, there's Sigourney Weaver, there is Tony Shalhoub, there is Alan Rickman. All right, Snape is in this movie. Sam Rockwell is in this movie. Who's the young kid that I really, really like? Justin Long. I love Justin Long, and he's in this movie, and one of my favorite characters in the film, even. And it's just a really talented cast, really smartly written, and a ton of fun. You really have to watch Galaxy Quest, okay? But, again, I'm talking about self-referential movies. I'm talking about deconstructionist films. And so to go along with that, I have a trio of movies that I typically put in this category. And Galaxy Quest is the first of them. The second one is Shakespeare in Love. Shakespeare in Love, it won Best Picture the year that it came out, and lots of people have since debated whether or not it actually deserved it. They refer to it as kind of simple and sappy and all that, but no. Yeah, you have to know your Shakespeare, but Shakespeare in Love is a brilliant film, okay? It is the story of Shakespeare as he's writing Romeo and Juliet, as he is living out a Shakespeare play. The whole story is told with Romeo in the same kind of stupid situations that wind up in all of his plays. All right, so we have, you know, a woman posing as a man. We have star-crossed lovers. We have, in the end, the big royal figure who comes in and just solves everyone's problems by royal authority and decree. You know, we have mistaken identities. It's very much a Shakespeare play. This is exactly what Shakespeare wrote, except here it is with Shakespeare himself as the star, while he is writing Romeo and Juliet, while he is writing exactly this sort of play. And I think it is beautifully done. It is a wonderful, wonderful story. Really highly recommend. Now, these first two, Galaxy Quest and Shakespeare in Love, I have watched both of those movies maybe 15 times apiece. All right, for the longest time, if I was ever home by myself, because I work for the state of Nebraska, and as a government employee, I often have days off that the rest of the family does not. I have some odd holidays like Arbor Day where I get to stay home. And so on days that I'd have a day to myself, I would come home and I would put on one of these movies and I would use it as the backdrop while I get stuff done around the house. All right, it's just a great, great thing for me because they're movies I know so well. And so I've seen them a million times as a result. Third one I'm going to put in this category, and this is where my science fiction double feature now becomes a triple, is the movie Soap Dish. And Soap Dish is Kevin Kline, Sally Field, Elizabeth Shue, looking great. And these people star in Soap Dish, which is a movie about the making of a television soap opera. A soap opera, which is apparently a dying art now. It is disappearing from American TV. But back when this movie was made, soap operas were hot. And Sally Field plays the obvious Susan Lucci character, all right? The character from Susan Lucci plays on All My Children, plays Erica Kane, I think is even the name of the character. I'm so sorry I know that. And Susan Lucci has been, you know, perpetually on this show. She's always been there, and she's still trying to play young, even though her character has, you know, children, grandchildren, you know, but and yet she's still trying to play young and the romantic interest, romantic lead. This is Sally Field, and she's threatened as the new young star is taking over. And so in Soap Dish, again, it's easy to dismiss it as a silly throwaway kind of movie, especially when you get Robert Downey Jr. in there, who, despite being a brilliant actor, his antics in it are just goony. Whoopi Goldberg is in this thing, for criminy sake. So it's easy to dismiss the movie. But, again, they take on the form of a soap opera. They have personal drama that is, you know, with you know, long-lost loves and, again, mistaken identities and deep, dark secrets being revealed. And all this stuff that goes on in a soap opera is also going on among the cast, and that's how they present it to us. And it is just brilliant. Okay, I don't know if you can hear this, but that is my son, Tada. Guess what? Today was a sick day, and Tada is home from school, and he has been laying in bed with a little bit of a fever all day long, but he's decided to come out and visit us. Say hi, kiddo.
Hello. Well, it's a nice time to be here, but we need to do Nerd Pride, right, Dad?
Right, kiddo. It is great to be part of the Nerd Club, isn't it?
Yeah.
You are bizarre. Give me a kiss. Mwah. Go play.
Okay.
You're awesome.
You're awesome, too.
That was my awesome, awesome son. Anyway, where did I leave off? I was talking about Soap Dish. And, again, it is just, it's a movie that takes the genre that it is making fun of and becomes it. And actually deconstructs it and picks it apart by being what it is and showing how silly it is. And yet by the end, again, there's a very warm and affectionate take on it. All three of these movies, I really like them because they obviously are making fun of something that they love. All right, they're picking it apart because they love it. There are other movies that work to take apart these kinds of genres. They work to take apart these kinds of movies. And sometimes they don't show that same level of affection for the subject matter. I mean, they come off as really bitter because, you know, well, this is a thing that's done and over with. And now it's just being, I think, like, Adaption. I love the movie Adaption. Adaption picks apart the way great novels are adapted into movies, and they're ruined because every movie has to suddenly become Die Hard. Every movie has to be an action thriller. You can't just have a movie based on a book and have a real drama. It has to be something bigger. But Adaption, as much as I love it, and I do, Adaption is a little bitter by the end of it. It is not, the writer is clearly not in love with this drama, action drama sort of thing that it is picking apart. And so I don't carry that one with me. I don't watch it and rewatch it like I do these other ones. Soap Dish, although I've only seen Soap Dish like three times, but I just found it on Netflix Instant Watch. It didn't used to be there. It is now. I am so going to watch it this weekend. I can't wait. This is going to be awesome. So, again, maybe we'll start up with a thread on the forums, talk about deconstructionist films. I know we've done something like that before, but I just love this kind of movie. And, again, these three in particular, Shakespeare in Love, Galaxy Quest, Soap Dish, great trio of movies. Highly recommend them. And when I'm not watching movies, I'll stop by my Nerd Pride turntable.
Jamboree handouts, two turntables and a microphone. Bottles and cans, just clap your hands, just clap your hands.
It's the turntable, just a wannabe music nerd talking about music. I don't have anything big this week. I just want to let you know that the new William Shatner album is just out. And it's, you know, go listen to some of the samples. Go hear some of them. I'm not saying buy the album, at least not yet. But he does some interesting stuff. First off, the album is called Seeking Major Tom, and it is space-themed, and the songs, if you can call them that, he doesn't sing, but the tracks tie into one another. He has little commentaries and stuff, and they tie into one another, and it's meant to be consumed, I assume, as this entire album. Joel has bought it, or at least has a copy of it, and has offered to let me listen. So I'm going to go through it. I've heard some samples and some stuff, but I haven't gotten the full effect yet. So maybe I'll report back with that. But I will tell you that his version of Blinded Me with Science is really good. That's one that I, even if I don't buy the whole album, I will probably buy Blinded Me with Science, because I just dig the way he does it. I dig his take on that. Whereas Bohemian Rhapsody, it's entertaining. I liked listening to his Bohemian Rhapsody because, oh my God, he Shatnerizes the heck out of this thing. He is emoting like crazy. He almost sings a couple of lines, and he is emoting, and he's, oh God, you can almost feel the fake tears that aren't quite there, and he's just so into it. And, it really reminds me of me as I perform stuff. So, you know, there's a fondness I have for that, and it's really entertaining to listen to his Bohemian Rhapsody, but it's not a track that I could listen to on a regular basis, or at least not yet. Although maybe it's a good one to break out at nerd parties, because what group of nerds wouldn't get off on being able to sing along with Shatner as a group to Bohemian Rhapsody? That's pretty awesome. Anyway, Joel has recommended a couple of tracks on there. Specifically, there's a duet with Lyle Lovett that he says is really good. And that would be on the song In a Little While, which I have not listened to yet. So anyway, all I have to do is tell you that there's a new Shatner album out. Holy cow! But now, you better get the little ones out of the room and make sure you're sitting down for this.
Nerd rage came flashing back, and I just looked at him and went, Rrr!
That's right, it's time for some nerd rage! Nothing big this week, just a small one. If I'm in a movie theater, and the movie has started, and I can see the light from your cell phone, then you are a douche. And that'll take us right into our music for the week. This week, I don't have a real theme. I've actually got a couple of different artists. And I'm doing cover songs, because you know how I like cover songs. And this one is a cover of Jay-Z's 99 Problems from a guy called Hugo. I love covers of hardcore rap. I love covers of rap songs done in any other style. All right? It doesn't even matter. I've got a country version of Gin and Juice that is just gorgeous. I love that. I've got Ben Folds Five, doing Bitches Ain't Shit. I've got a group that my brother introduced me to from Texas called Dynamite Hack doing Boys in the Hood. I've got others. I love remakes in any style of rap songs. And this is one of my favorites. This is 99 Problems. Take a listen.
If you haven't got problems, I feel bad for your son. I got 99 problems and a bitch ain't one. Tip my hat to the sun in the west. Feel the beat right in my chest. At the crossroads a second time. Make the devil change his mind. But it's really a ton. 99 problems and a bitch ain't one. If you haven't got problems, I feel bad for your son. I got 99 problems and a bitch ain't one. 99 problems, but a bitch ain't one.
See, that is just smooth. I love that. But enough of the music. Right now, it's time for the badass movie quote of the week. This week's quote comes from Night of the Hunter. Let me just start it off. Ah, little lad, you're staring at my fingers. Would you like me to tell you the little story of the right hand, left hand? The story of good and evil? H-A-T-E. It was with this left hand that old brother Cain struck the blow that laid his brother low. L-O-V-E. You see these fingers, dear hearts? These fingers has veins that run straight to the soul of a man. The right hand, friends, the hand of love. Now watch, and I'll show you the story of life. Those fingers, dear hearts, is always a warring and a tugging one against the other. Now watch 'em. Old brother left hand, he's a fightin', and it looks like love's a goner. But wait a minute! Hot dog loves a winning. Yes, siree. It's love that's won. And the old left hand, hate, is down for the count. That doesn't sound terribly badass. Did you realize that's Robert Mitchum doing that? Robert Mitchum, the original Love and Hate tattooed across the knuckles, Night of the Hunter, that's the movie that did that, all right? And Robert Mitchum, in this story, despite being a preacher and telling his story of love and hate and love winning over hate in this little story, he is the most evil dude to ever grace a movie screen. He is just scary as all get out in this movie. This movie, if you've never seen Night of the Hunter, is simple, all right? The sets are cheap, all right? They're traveling down the river, and the set is clearly a rolling painted backdrop. They're not even pretending that it's anything other than that, and it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. The way they carry this off, it gets into your soul, and Robert Mitchum is scary in this film. And so knowing the evil that's in him, knowing the kind of man he is when he starts telling this story, it just gives you chills. Plus, he also says the phrase hot dog, which I do every week, and I love using hot dog. I think that's an awesome phrase. No, I'm not kidding. I mean, this is the kind of guy that later on in the same film, he says lines like, no, you don't touch that, little lamb. Don't touch my knife. That makes me mad. That makes me very, very mad. See, he's scary, scary and evil, and he kills people. So that is our badass movie quote of the week, Robert Mitchum in Night of the Hunter. What was the name of the role? Reverend Harry Powell. There you go. I had to look it up. But Night of the Hunter, great, great film. 1955. Totally worth your time. But having done the badass movie quote of the week, what do we do next? It's time for the word of the week. That's right. It's time for the word of the week. And your mission with the word of the week is to take this word. Well, in fact, it's a phrase this week, but take this phrase and make it your own. All right. Learn it. Love it. Come to know it. Make use of it in casual conversation. Impress your friends. This will A, let us know that you listen to the podcast, and B, it'll show that you are smart enough to apply the knowledge that you've gained. How can you possibly argue with that? Our phrase this week is Katie bar the door. I love this phrase. If you've been on our forums, I started a thread a while back talking about words because I love words. That's why I do the word of the week. And I've used this one already, but I really, really dig Katie bar the door. If you're not familiar with it, it's actually more often than not lately in the last 10 years used by sports announcers. Katie bar the door. It means prepare, trouble's coming. Okay. And that means, you know, when all of a sudden the other team's turned it over and they're headed back down the field this way, and now it's Katie bar the door. There's no stopping them now. You got to be ready for it, ready for trouble. Katie bar the door is an awesome phrase, very evocative. But more importantly, is where it came from. This is what makes this thing so cool to me. Because I've actually known the phrase, heard the phrase Katie bar the door for years. I've known it since I was a kid. I've never actually used it, but I know what it is. Well, I'm going to change that now because it's too cool a phrase to let die. This one comes from an old Scottish legend of Catherine Douglas, Katie. Apparently, Catherine Douglas was the Queen's lady-in-waiting, the King and Queen of Scotland, remember. They were traveling, and there was a plot to assassinate the King in his bed. Right? The conspirators had arranged to remove the bar from the King's door. That way, it couldn't be bolted. The conspirators could sneak in the middle of the night, kill everybody. This was their plan. So in the night, the assassins show up. All right, the King and Queen are trying to escape, and the Queen yells to Catherine, to Katie, to secure the door. All right, Katie bar the door. This is the original thing. So Katie goes over there, and of course, realizing that the bar has been stolen, there's no way to bar the door, to lock the door from this side. Katie goes ahead and puts her own arm through the door where the bar would have gone in order to secure it. So she puts it through those metal rings and uses her own arm as the bar on the door. You can imagine how this is going to go when there's three guys on the other side throwing their weight against it. So the assassins force the door open and completely break Katie's arm in the process, and then went on to kill the King anyway. So her efforts were really for nothing. But that kind of bravery earns her a place in legend. And after that, being a legend now, she takes on the name of Katie Barless. That's what she goes by. Barless Barlass. All right, not as in bar as in tavern, but bar as in the damn steel bar that goes through the door to hold it shut. She was the bar girl. That was her. That's the equivalent of someone today naming themselves Immovable Girl or something like that. I mean, this girl was a superhero. This was, I mean, to actually do that. And this was, you know, 15th century, 1600s that this happened. So, you know, 400 years later, 450 years later, we are still using the phrase, well, okay, not we, but some people are using the phrase, Katie bar the door, in honor of that. So the story of Katie Barless gets handed down through legend, makes its way to an American poem that uses the phrase, Catherine keep the door. That was the way it's done there. And over the years, Catherine keep the door has just been altered to Katie bar the door, and that's how we use it today. We're talking an American figure of speech, and it is purely an American figure of speech at this point, that originates from a 400, 500-year-old Scottish legend of a Supergirl. Pretty darn cool. So if you can find any way to use Katie bar the door in everyday conversation, do it this week. Go out, tell your friends, or come to the forums, find something immense going on our forums, and use the term Katie bar the door to describe it or prepare for it. We will honor you. As a side note, I should put in that Katie was an actual real person. The king in question was James I of Scotland, and he really was assassinated. It was his own Chamberlain, in fact, who betrayed him and removed the bolt from the door for the assassins. The part about her putting her arm through the brackets and getting her arm snapped and thus earning herself a place in legend, we don't know if it's true or not, but we're going to choose to believe it because it's too awesome to not be true. See? Good enough. Time for a little more music. In this particular case, this cover song, I told you we were going to be doing cover songs this time. This cover song is from a group called the Carolina Chocolate Drops. I love the Carolina Chocolate Drops. I love everything I've heard by them. They're really good. This is from their album Genuine Negro Jig, and they're doing a cover of Blue Cantrell's Hit 'Em Up Style. And I don't know if you remember Hit 'Em Up Style. It was Blue Cantrell's, I think, only hit a few years ago. But it's essentially it's an R&B girl's revenge tune. She's caught her man cheating or whatever, I assume cheating. And so therefore, the way to get him back is to spend all of his money, all right? Go sell his stuff, grab his credit card, spend all his cash, and put him in the poorhouse. That'll teach him to cheat on you. And this is Carolina Chocolate Drops' version of that. It's really good.
I was beaming in his beamer, just beaming. Can't believe that I caught my man cheating. So I found another way to make him pay for it all. So I went to Neiman Marcus on a shopping spree, and on the way I grabbed Soleil and Mia. And as the cash box rang, I threw everything away. Your hands on his cash and spend it to the last time for all the hard times. When you go, then everything goes from the crib to the ride in the clothes. So you better let him know that if he messes up, you gotta hit him up.
See, I've always said the best cover song is a cover song that is something that you're familiar with, a song that you know already. So you have that familiarity built in. But even if you didn't know the song, it's just good music. And that is a song I love, especially that intro music. I love the music to this one. I think it's beautiful. Really, really well done. So I hope you guys enjoyed that. But having finished our music, you know what it's time for? The Pod-O-Matic! Hot dog! This is Nerd Pride Radio's Pod-O-Matic. At the end of every cast, I bring out R2 in his fully pimped out Pod-O-Matic bubble. He rolls up random topics for me to talk about. Where do these topics come from, you might ask? Well, that's where you come in. You want to hear me haver on about something? Well, then you send your questions or topics to me by email, or better yet, send it to me as a private message on our forums, and I will add it to our Pod-O-Matic list. This Pod-O-Matic is about whatever you want it to be. And amazingly, R2's first number is the number one. We're going straight to the top of the list for one from Brasky. And this is a Kiss Mary Kill, he says. Obviously the sanitized version of the F Mary Kill. So, in this Kiss Mary Kill version, my choices are Molly Ringwald, Ally Sheedy, or Neil Patrick Harris. He adds the note, assume that you are choosing each one of them from whatever you consider to be their prime. See, this is in their prime. That's where I have a real problem with this one. Because if I take them when they're in their prime, then the person I clearly want for unbridled wild night of passionate kissing, a wild night of snogging, as it were, my choice would be Molly Ringwald. But how the problem with that is, when she was in her prime, was when she was making all of her movies, that's when I was most in love with her, is when she was, I don't know, 16 or 17 when she was doing that, and that would be really, really wrong. I can hardly request a 16-year-old Molly Ringwald right now. So we're going to have to make some modifications to this and just assume that whatever kissing goes on is all age-appropriate, and we'll assume that this is back when I was in high school, because Molly Ringwald is my age, so there ain't nothing wrong with that. So that's going to be my first choice, is Molly Ringwald for the kissing. And that leaves me to choose between Ally Sheedy and Neil Patrick Harris. And obviously, if I've got to marry somebody, I'm going to marry Neil Patrick Harris. Neil Patrick Harris in his prime? Yeah, that means right now. None of this Doogie Howser crap. Neil Patrick Harris is awesome. Right? I love this man. He is spectacular. He is incredibly wealthy. He seems incredibly cool and personable and fun and very real. His boyfriend might not like it, but I don't care. I'm marrying him anyway, so that's my choice. That only leaves me Ally Sheedy to kill. Ally Sheedy, who, as much as I found her really, really attractive back in the day, was really kind of a second banana sort of actress for me. I mean, she was cute, but she was never all that talented. And sorry, gotta let her go. So, kissing Molly Ringwald, marrying Neil Patrick Harris. Putting Ally Sheedy 6 feet under. That's just the way it's going to have to go. Number 12. R2 gives us one from Nadia. All right, Nadia. Nadia says, Nadia says, are baby bugbears referred to as larva cubs? How dare you? How dare you? Let me actually roll down through the Podomatic list, because I know there's another bugbear entry in here from Brasky somewhere. Yep, there it is. Brasky says, bugbears are freaking awesome. Prove me right. Yeah, see, Nadia, bugbears are awesome. And your joke, see, there's a problem, is many years ago when I first mentioned bugbears, one of the staple monsters from Dungeons & Dragons, Nadia could do nothing but laugh because, to her, the name bugbear is funny. All right, you know what? Bugbear is a traditional name. It comes from the same source as boogeyman. It is the early form of goblins, boogeyman, creatures in the night. It's a bugbear, damn it! Why is this so tough? But the name apparently makes her laugh, and she has never stopped writing me about this. But as Brasky says, bugbears are freaking awesome. They are the greatest of the goblinoid races in Dungeons & Dragons, and any game for that matter. They're awesome. They are 7.5 feet tall. They're huge, hairy, hulking monsters, and really made out well in the D&D 3rd edition books. Their pictures, their depiction there was just spectacular. Because when it comes to, they are just pure bestial nature, this huge, raw power goblinoid creature. And in one of the illustrations, from the D&D stuff, D&D 3rd edition stuff, the dude is armored and armed, and he's, you know, huge and hulking with his big old morning star and everything else going on. And, oh, by the way, he also has a fork stuck in his shoulder, and they have absolutely no explanation for why that would be there. It is a piece of cutlery, a piece of tableware stabbed into his shoulder and just standing there. That is badass. That is why bugbears rock, and you can take your larva cub crap and you can just stuff it, because we don't put up with that here. We love our bugbears. Number 81. This one is from Billy Bob. Billy Bob sent me new entries this week. I'm happy. I was afraid that we were running out. Billy Bob says, in the opening, you keep referring to your second favorite or third luckiest number or whatever. What is your actual favorite or luckiest number? Oh, I can't tell you that. You're going to have to wait till that episode rolls around. It's all part of my intros. As it turns out, I can give you a hint. When it comes to favorite numbers or lucky numbers, I am big on primes. I love prime numbers. All right. And that's why, 13 is my second favorite number, and 7 is my third. I love prime numbers, and 7 and 13 work really well for me. I just don't know what it is about them. But I mean, and any prime number, but the low prime numbers are good. All right, not 2 and 3. 2 and 3 are too common. But 7, skip 11, but 7, 11, 13, 17 is a great one. 19, not so bad. I mean, there's just, you know, anyway, I'm afraid if I keep going, I'm going to give away too much. I don't want to spoil the surprise, clearly, because this is a big issue. We want to save it for the right moment. But I appreciate the question, Billy Bob. Thanks for getting back in it, man. Bam! Number 53. This one is from, it's from the Zimny Pot. We can't have a Pot-O-Matic without the Zimny, right? Zimny asks, do you prefer to be behind the camera or in front of it? All right, you've listened to, this is the 14th episode you've heard me in now. Take your guess. I love being the center of attention. I love to talk. I love to hear myself talk. I love to go back through my old stuff and read things that I've read because I like looking at me. I am such a narcissist. I am so full of my own ego. It is just ridiculous. Of course I like being in front of the camera. Although, actually, more than anything, I really like being on the mics. All right. This is my camera. This is what I'm doing. Put me on an actual camera, and then I have to worry about whether or not I'm fat, and do I look like a slob? Am I slouching? I didn't brush my hair today. I don't, you know. But I'm sure I could get over that pretty quickly. Like I say, the way my sons have taken to theater and drama and the acting bug, I imagine that if I had gone into drama in high school, if I had, you know, taken this up as a hobby my whole life, I would have the exact same love. I love performing. I love showing off for people. I'm not going to deny that. It's who I am. And R2 has just rolled us up a big number 7. This one is from Stan. Stan says, what was the first science fiction story to blow your mind? Oh, dude. You know what? Okay. Okay, see, this is the kind of question that I need to prepare for. I'm going to say the story Dust, but I'm not going to say the story Dust because I didn't read that one until I was in college. So that was 20 years ago almost. And I know that I had a deep love of science fiction before college. I'll get back to Dust in a minute. Let me back all the way up. The very first, earliest science fiction I can remember reading, and the stuff that just rocked me, the stuff that made me fall in love with science fiction to start with. I loved anything having to do with space. All right, I remember an early story of kids living on a space station. It was a moon station. It went through all the details of the physics of, you know, how many rotations the thing went through and what the gravity does and how things float around in space and tricks you can play with the ventilation. And it was just bizarre. And I read this as, I don't know, a 7-year-old, 8-year-old. Loved it. No, it had to be a little bit older than that. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Fell in love with it just because it was space and I was getting these details of it and it was so real to me at that point. I just loved it. I would devour anything in the magazines, whether it was, you know, Newsweek or People or National Geographic or Boy's Life. If it was talking about space, I was there. All right. Watching the Pioneer missions take off, the Voyager missions, knowing that it was going to be, you know, 15 years before we ever saw these get to Jupiter or get to Saturn, knowing it's going to be 20 years, 30 years before they got to Pluto, and thinking, I will never see that happen. And now I've seen it happen. It's really cool. But I loved all that stuff. And so the first ones I can remember the title to, because there was that space station one, there was a time-traveling one, I read like crazy in fourth and fifth grade, read like crazy through every science fiction book I could get my hands on. And in fifth grade, I remember Danny Dunn, The Invisible Boy. Now, I don't know if anyone else is familiar with the Danny Dunn books. I've never seen them since my library when I was in fifth grade. The school library had a whole shelf full of Danny Dunn, and I ate them up. Danny Dunn, Invisible Boy, Danny Dunn and his two friends, his two sidekicks. It was a trio very much like Harry, Ron, and Hermione. The trio of them apparently lived next door to some nutty inventor professor guy, and so every week they would show up and something weird or bizarre or amazing was happening in his lab, and it would send them on some great adventure. So Danny Dunn, Invisible Boy, was the mad scientist guy has a dragonfly with cameras and speakers mounted in it, so you could pilot the dragonfly by remote control while wearing these special virtual reality goggles, and you could see what the dragonfly saw. It was a little mini spy drone, and it was really cool. There's another one where I know they time traveled back to Revolutionary War times. I know they met Ben Franklin and I think Thomas Jefferson. Danny Dunn did all sorts of stuff like that, and I just remember being completely caught up in that, the excitement of it. And it wasn't just that it was an exciting story. I'd read exciting stories in other genres, but I was specifically, every book, it was, what was the science going to be? What was the science thing going to be, especially the time travel? Oh, I love the time travel. That was so great. But after that, I mean, there's all sorts of stuff that got me hooked. I mean, I remember that, and then I remember in seventh grade getting into maybe it was sixth grade. It doesn't matter. Everything by Ray Bradbury. I read everything that Bradbury wrote through sixth, seventh, eighth grade. I read everything by anything. All right, but the first one that I remember that I literally got done reading a story and I had to put the book down and go, whoa, I never thought of that. Something that just completely knocked my socks off. Not just amazing and wonderful and wondrous like watching a great movie, but a concept that totally blew me away was the story Dust. I don't even remember the author's name. I remember I read it in college, and it was in some best of science fiction anthology. I don't know if it was an award-winning anthology or just a best of, because I read the best of anthologies for many years and loved them. These huge, huge dictionary-sized books of science fiction and fantasy and horror. They were wonderful. And Dust was about a man whose brain has been backed up into a computer system. Whatever happened, his physical body is gone, and now he is nothing but a virtual person on a computer. Apparently all of his memories are stored there. And they go through the difficulties of him waking up, realizing he's a virtual person, going through this realization process, and then he, quote-unquote, dies or ends himself, but he comes back because, well, he's just saved. He's copied. You know, there's always a backup of him. You can't get rid of him. And as it goes through, it's, okay, but let's take that saved copy, and it's not just a saved copy on a disk or on a computer here in front of us. What if we're sending it out through the internet? And there wasn't even an internet at the time in the sense we think of it nowadays. It was just beginning back then. What if we send it out through the phone lines, through the satellite system, through the, and now bits and points of his consciousness are now no longer saved anywhere. All right, they're actually all constantly in motion, divided up between different sections. So he has part of him saved in a computer bank in Russia and part of him in this computer sitting in front of his ex-wife in New Jersey or wherever it was, and part of him floating around in the ether waiting to join up with the others, and yet he still thinks and he still functions because all those points can communicate. He is Dust. And I am not doing this story justice. I just remember it was a story about what consciousness is, what personhood is, what it means to exist, to be, and to be a person, to be a thinking entity. And it just blew me away. Absolutely knocked my socks off. That was the single most amazing thing I had read to that point. I highly recommend it. I will try and look it up. I will do some research and see. I know somebody brought the story up on another forum about 6 or 7 years ago. And I remember going, oh, I've read that. And then whoever it was actually came up with the name of the story, the author, well, I mean, the name is Dust, but came up with the author and then linked to it. And it was actually available for reading online, which I don't know if that was legal or not, but it was there. So if I can find it again, I'll try and point people to it because it was really, really cool. God, that's a great question, Stan. I just realized I'm rambling, and I hope I'm not boring everybody, but it just occurred to me that I could talk about science fiction books that I've read for hours. Apparently, this is a stored up font of information that I haven't ever delved into. So I appreciate that, Stan. Thank you. Number 59. Oh my God, another one from Billy Bob. Go Billy Bob. When someone is waiting for the elevator and the call button is clearly lit, why does the next person to come along invariably hit that button anyway? Yeah, well, for the same reason that you will stand there by yourself and push the button 7 or 8 times, thinking it's going to make it go faster. Look, here's what it comes down to. With someone else standing there and they've got the button lit, they've already obviously pressed it, but I come along and I press it myself anyway, is because what if, I don't know, can you trust the light? What if they didn't really hit it? You'd hate to be just standing there like a couple of idiots with everyone's thinking that someone else pushed the button, but nobody ever actually pushed the button. So you just do it yourself just to be safe. But that's not even the most relevant thing. I just had a run-in with someone about elevator buttons like 3 weeks ago, and we're standing in an elevator. It was not in my usual building. I must have been in Lincoln or something. I was at a conference, a special meeting, who knows what. And I get in, and everyone's loaded up, and oh, wait, we had to stop the door. Okay, now everyone's in. And I go ahead and I hit the door close button. On the inside of every elevator, they have a door open button and a door close button. If you hit the door open, you can hold the door open by holding that button instead of having to just stick your arm out there in front of the door like we all do anyway. If you hit the door close button, one would dream that it closes the door faster. And in this case, it didn't. I hit the door close button and nothing happened. And so the guy standing next to me, young dude, says, yeah, you know, those aren't connected. I'm like, well, yeah, clearly it didn't work. He says, no, by law, they don't connect those anymore. Yeah, they have them because, you know, they've always had them, but by law, they disconnect the door close buttons. I'm like, what are you talking about? And I didn't say that, but clearly the puzzlement was on my face. And so he starts speaking with the authority of, well, in the building I used to work with, yeah, I talked to the maintenance guys, and they said that they're required to disconnect those. And no, I wanted to punch him in the face. You know why? Because I work in a building that has an elevator, and it's only a three-story building, but I carry a lot of computers and heavy equipment, and I'm pushing carts around all the time. I need the elevator a lot. That's how you get stuff from floor to floor. And in the elevator that I have that is literally 10 feet from my office, if I get in that elevator and I do not touch any button on the inside, that door takes a good 10 seconds, 12 seconds before it starts closing. If I get in the elevator and I see no one else is coming, I punch the door close button. It just finished opening, and if I hit the door close button, it shuts immediately. It clearly works. The button works, and this idiot is telling me right to my face that, oh yeah, no, by law, they're required to disconnect those because he heard from somebody else, and this is how misinformation gets passed around. This is one of the things I have, is the way the human mind works, and I know I'm sure there's great survival evolutionary reasons for why our brains do this and why we justify stupid information, but it just kills me that this guy, somebody else told him that those buttons are disconnected by law. Okay, he didn't see the law, he didn't talk to a lawmaker, it was someone else in the old building he used to work at told him that, oh, by law, those are disconnected. And now when he passes it on to me, he passes it on with ultimate authority because he can't present it as something that he's doubtful about because he saw the doubt on my face, and he's not allowed to be wrong. He's not allowed to be mistaken. It's not allowed to be a rumor or something that he thinks is true. No, it has to be absolutely true. Okay? And so he presents it to me with the authority of, no, I talked to a guy and he told me that, and he speaks it with such authority that it has to be right. And it's a minor thing. And I didn't say anything to him, even though as he's telling this to my face, I know that the closed door button works on some elevators, and I know it doesn't on others. And I know that what he's saying is completely and totally incorrect, and yet I'm not going to confront him because how are you going to explain that? I mean, so no, it does too, does not. There's no going on with that. You can't argue with someone once they've got, because once I challenge him on it, I mean, he's already presented it to me as he is the authority, and he's presented backup facts. He's got a citation. It's like Wikipedia. He can't be wrong now. And if I challenge that, it's going to turn into a needless argument over an elevator button with a stranger. There's no point in that at all. But it was just terribly, terribly frustrating. And it's just a small representation of the kind of arguments that we get into with people every single day that drive me friggin' nuts. All right, this is going to be the last one. Number 67, thank you, R2. This one's from The Phantom. The Phantom says, what is your favorite Lucky Charms marshmallow? I'm partial to purple horseshoes myself. Oh, please. All right. green clover is the only Lucky Charms marshmallow worth its salt, clearly. And there is quite a bit of salt in them. Here's the deal about Lucky Charms marshmallows. I remember when there were just four. All right. I was there. Man, back in the day, back when it was, you know, green clovers, what was it? Green clovers, pink hearts, yellow moons, orange stars. That was it. Right? And then after that, they added in Blue Diamonds. And I remember when they added Blue Diamonds, and I thought, man, that has got to be the coolest thing in the world. We have a new Lucky Charms marshmallow. It is as if it's the second coming of Christ. It really was. It was that glorious. Because, I mean, you know what I know? I was a little kid. And this must happen to a lot of little kids when they're the first time that they're old enough to notice that, oh my God, they changed my cereal. This is awesome. We have to run out and grab it. This is the greatest marketing tool ever for these people. This is wonderful. I mean, Lucky Charms has changed, what, once a year? Twice a year for, I don't know, my entire life? I mean, first it was adding in the Blue Diamonds, all right? And then it was Blue Diamonds and Purple Horseshoes. And then Blue Diamonds and Purple Horseshoes and, what, Red Balloons? I can't remember what was next. Pots of Gold. They had, it just went on and on. And then, at one point, I remember when they introduced Green Clovers, my favorite marshmallow. And I'm like, wait a minute, they introduced Green Clovers? When did they take out Green Clovers? Are you serious? So, these people are just clever. And, you know, other cereals can make changes. Other cereals can add, you know, Count Chocula can go for, ooh, now with huge ghost-shaped marshmallows. All right, you know what? You're all just a bunch of copycats. Trix can go with swirls, and Trix can go with fruit flavors and fruit shapes and fruit. All right, it doesn't work with any of the other cereals, but for Lucky Charms. Ooh, I love the Lucky Charms. They just came out with, in fact, this is the best, I think, what, just in the last week, 2 weeks? They've suddenly come out with their blitz for their new 5 new marshmallows. They're adding 5 new marshmallows at once. It's, oh, such bounty we have never known. It is incredible. Of course, the 5 marshmallows, they're all stars, and they're all swirled with white and whatever color, so it's not like they're terribly original. But Green Clovers, that's the answer. This podcast is copyright 2011 by Nerd Pride Radio. The featured music this week was 99 Problems by Hugo and Hit 'Em Up Style by the Carolina Chocolate Drops. The opening and closing theme is from the Beastie Boys' Sabotage as performed by the Penelopes. The bumper clips are taken from Everything Right is Wrong Again by They Might Be Giants, She Blinded Me with Science from Thomas Dolby, Beck's Where It's At, As Seen on TV by White Appletree, Richard O'Brien with Science Fiction Double Feature, and Words by Missing Persons. All bumper music, all clips, is available on iTunes. Please go check them out. Please buy them. I wouldn't put them in my show if I didn't love them to death. If you feel like doing something nice for this podcast, head on over to iTunes. Write us a nice review. If you want to contact me, you can always email me at mike@nerdprideradio.com or check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/nerdprideradio. But to be totally honest with you, the best way to talk to me truly is come over to our forums. Sign up, nerdprideradio.com/forums. Send me a message. Hang out. Have fun. Yo, man, what's wrong? Are you nerd? Or is that what they teach you up at that sissy school of yours, how to forget who your friends are? Well, let me tell you something. I don't care what they teach you up there. You're either nerd or you ain't nerd. So the question is, are you nerd or what? You ain't nerd. You ain't nothing. You ain't nothing.